They're all separate. Mr. Hogan, if you just state your name for the record.
Jay Hogan, Director of Legislative Finance. And would you like me to?
Well, I would like you to tell us the reason why you're putting this in, and I understand it's a result of a trip that motivated a couple of years ago.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, the memorandum that many of you all have summarizes it, but what happened was several years ago, the leadership of the finance committees at that time went to Denver to see the operation of the Colorado General Assembly, and particularly their joint budget committee structure. And they sat in on some hearings and talked with the various members of the committee. At that time, the delegation that went was rather favorably impressed with the concept, but it wasn't until this year that legislation was actually introduced, and there is legislation this year on both sides. Basically, what the instructions were to me in drafting this legislation was to create a joint budget subcommittee of the Budget and Audit Committee under the theory that same groups of people were already members of the Budget and Audit Committee, the presumed membership of the Joint Budget Committee, and that it seemed a logical place to place it. That's why this arrangement of making it a subcommittee was selected. What it would do, Bill, would take three members from each side. It would take the chairman of the Senate and House Finance Committees, make them members of the Joint Budget Subcommittee, and then it would take a majority and a minority member from each Finance Committee and make them the remaining four members. You'd then have six from each side, and it would be constructed exactly the same as the free conference on the budget, which is incidentally exactly the way Colorado structures their program. And attached to the last page of the memo, you can see that a good many state legislatures also structure their free conference committees on appropriation bills in a similar fashion. The number 3 and 3 appears frequently throughout the listing of the states. And the thought was that under the system that we currently use, we have a budget developed through the course of the session by the House Finance Committee and one developed by the Senate Finance Committee. On the surface, it seems like two separate budgets with two separate approaches. Actually, it can be more than that. This year, the House Finance Committee is essentially using a committee of the whole approach. The Senate Finance Committee is using a subcommittee approach. So it is conceivably possible to have a variety of approaches even within a committee as to how a budget should be treated. By that I mean there are different methods and tools used to arrive at the budget figures depending upon the assumptions and policy guidelines that a particular subcommittee sets down, as well as a committee as of the whole. So one of the things that this concept sought to address was to standardize, if you will, and attempt to standardize the approach to setting the budget. The advantages of this, as far as the legislature and the finance committees were concerned, one is that a lot of work which is currently in duplication or triplication, if you will, of the final product would be not necessary. There would be a legislative product developed. The legislative product, the legislative budget, would be a more coherent document. It would follow a certain set of guidelines from the beginning elements of the budget right through the end. It was felt that it could be better researched, and that the half a dozen people who were charged exclusively with this responsibility, let's say exclusively to the point of preparing the document to present to each house, would be relieved of some other duties, in essence, they'd delegate those duties, and they would have more time, Gary, to spend on this preparation. They would be able to give the staff more cohesive direction. This concept in Colorado has relied quite heavily on a lot of staff work to prepare the document, but not from the standpoint of staff just sitting down and saying, gee, this is a great idea to do this, that, or the other thing, but to follow directions set by the supervisory committee, to go back and prepare recommendations and then bring them back to the committee for their review and final approval. So the staff gets a better sense of what it is the committee wants to do in this kind of arrangement. And those were some of the advantages that members who made the trip saw. Also, one last one that is perhaps more of an interest here than it has been in Colorado, only because they have been more involved in it. The legislative intent compliance, it was felt that if executive agencies knew that they were being closely watched by a group of legislators who represented who supported and defended, if you will, the decisions of the whole legislature with regard to the budget, that compliance with legislative intent might possibly improve substantially over what we have experienced. We've had some areas where there's been good compliance with legislative intent, others where it's been less than what we might hope. It was felt that perhaps a more centralized approach like this would improve compliance. And finally, the last item is discussed as a practical one. The legislative budget that is currently produced by the Alaska Legislature is produced by six people. The Free Conference Committee on the Budget writes the budget that the legislature passes. It incorporates a great deal of detail and a great deal of the numbers that were prepared on both sides. But it also incorporates a substantial number of new programs that were not in either budget. Now, this is particularly true in the capital budget. So when the final gong is sounded, if you will, we incorporate the streamlined approach in using our free conference system to develop a budget, but we do not incorporate it throughout the full length of the production of the product, if you will, the budget. Only in the last, depending upon how long free conference meets, essentially 2 weeks. A normal time. However, we have had some free conferences that have met for substantially longer than that.
Well, as I understand it, and correct me as I'm wrong because I'm new to the game and I have some time, this would be an ongoing, and it sounds like it'd be a pretty powerful one.
Yes, sir. That's true. This is probably the area that is most strenuously objected to by members of legislative bodies in places where groups such as this exist. And I think possibly it has to be looked at in a trade-off manner. And that is, if the body selects its people with care and puts in their hands this kind of responsibility, then obviously they have to keep tabs on what they're doing, and keep up with what they're doing. It's been my own personal experience from watching the legislature, this legislature, operate, that the free conference committees on the budget have really bent over backwards to try and accommodate as wide a selection of the legislative body as they can. There are obviously good reasons for that. But the trade-off for loss of large numbers of people having a direct feeling of budget comes from these other advantages, in that the better informed members are, the members who actually set the budget, the better budget they write, and the better able they are to defend every action that is taken in that budget, and the better able they are to hold these items in the budget against veto. So the Colorado General Assembly has anguished over this very same question. What are all these, the rest of the legislature, the power they're giving up? But they've always traded off in their minds, apparently since the system has existed for so long, they've traded off in their minds the belief that, well, this committee, because it's ongoing, because it's better equipped to deal with the budget, does a better job looking out for our collective interest than we could do if we went back to the Consumer Bank of Colorado, than they could do if we went back to large appropriations.
I'd like to ask one more question. As far as following through on the thought of there's always a great deal of concern and intent for veto, and you mentioned that they could follow through or be more informed, how would they be able to function better than, say, we are now, and we're just kind of redlined out of items with being an advantage of this? What would the advantage be?
The advantage, Mr. Chairman, is twofold. We have two types of redlining now. We had some redlining last year of intent. The Budget and Audit Committee, as it currently exists, could argue over the governor's use of the line item veto on specific items of intent. But the Budget and Audit Committee is, say traditionally, but it is currently, and has been at other times in kind of not composed of the majority of finance committee members. The other members of the legislature do not necessarily have all the thinking and information that went into particular items. So it slips, due to the pressure of the business of the Budget and Audit Committee, it slips to a lesser rank of priority. That doesn't mean it has to be that way, but it means that it is that way. And so we find that under the existing structure, where you don't always incorporate the people who made the decision and who followed the decision all the way through into the Budget and Audit Committee structure, you don't get, in all cases, the same kind of concern for those items, because some of the people just turn them off, and so that it doesn't mean as much. Or it isn't as clear to them what the argument is. Another thing that happens in cases where a small committee exists is if a governor feels that he's going to be subjected to a tremendous amount of hassle from the veto, maybe he won't veto it. It's been my experience from working with the Colorado General Assembly, I think they had a little better control over that issue. They had a little more persuasive force, if you will, against the veto, because this committee, which has existed for so long, it just stacks up as a very formidable opponent, and the governor is apt to think more about reduction in the budget, because he knows he's going to have to go up against a fairly hard-hitting argument delivered by these people to prepare the budget from start to finish.
Jay, what happens to the rest of the members of the House and Senate Finance Committee? Do they have to bother to have the meetings anymore?
Mr. Chairman, do you happen to have that list of the little summary that comes out, I suspect not. I can bring one with me, but there's a wide variety of bills that are referred to the Finance Committee. This concept is envisioned to deal only with the budget bill and supplemental appropriations. The full standing Finance Committee will continue to hear the, and be assigned full responsibility for all special and new program appropriations, all bills with fiscal impact, and all bond meetings. That's perhaps not that apparent, but that's what is in effect being said. In, on page 2, line 4, review request for state agency annual program appropriations and supplemental appropriations. So their authority is limited to the budget and the supplemental appropriations. The full standing Finance Committees would hear the other. There's another listing which I suspect would show it better, but the bulk of the bills that are in both Finance Committees are bills with fiscal impact and fiscal notes and cash or special appropriations for bond bills. And the minority of bills are something that normally would get, I'd say, 20 to 30 supplemental appropriations that were passed in a given year, and then the general appropriations. The rest of the workload of the Finance Committee would be continued to be assigned exactly as it is. The division of labor that would be possible in that would mean that those persons on the Finance Committee structure who are not part of the Budget and Audit Committee, or the Joint Budget Committee structure, would have more time to devote to the individual measures for their science than perhaps they do currently. There's a bit of a difference, Mr. Chairman, perhaps between the way the House and Senate might look at this, although perhaps then again there isn't. On the House side, most of the committee members are freed of all other committee responsibilities. That's quite obviously not the case in the Senate. You have a great many, usually a majority of the membership in the Senate Finance Committee who has the chairmanship somewhere else. So the workload is extremely heavy. On the House side, you have an additional factor in that there are a lot of new members that frequently find themselves on the Finance Committee. And to deal with both the budget category and appropriation bills sometimes is a substantial load. This division of labor that's possible under this kind of setup, I think might prove to be useful.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Jay, it appears to me, though, that the three members from each side on the Joint Budget Committee are going to have to not only be doing the Joint Budget Committee's work, but they're also members of the Finance Committee and also carrying a load on the Finance Committee. So you might be lightening the load on the other members.
There's no doubt about that. Yes, the load on the three members from each side who are members of the Joint Budget Committee is heavy. There's absolutely no question about that. In the Colorado situation, what they have done is they have carefully selected someone who has the time to devote to the work and who is willing to put in the hours, because it does take a good bit of time.
Senator Bradley, do you have any questions? Senator Zimmerman? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'll just leave this with the committee. This is a booklet that came out this past year. It was prepared by Senator Joe Shoemaker, who was for several years chairman of the Colorado Joint Budget Committee, And he has written this book from his vantage point as a legislator, serving 12 years with the Colorado General Assembly. It's, unfortunately, we don't have enough to supply everybody, but if I could, I'd leave this with a committee, and those members who are interested in it, enjoy it.
I think that there's...
Mr. Chairman, I have a suggested amendment. On page 1, line 27, strike that sentence and amend it to read, the subcommittee is composed of Senators Mulcahy, Ziegler, Bradley, and Kelly. Mulcahy, Bradley, and Kelly.
Right. I think I'd like to look at this a little longer and check into it a little deeper to get a better understanding. Did you have another question?
Just what's the status of the other version?
Mr. Chairman, the bills are identical.
It's in House Finance.
House Finance.
I don't have any strong feelings on this, Chairman. Something to try with a 1 year's expiration date.
I'd like to look at it a little bit more. There's some things coming out here that I hadn't read into. Let's look at House Bill 84, an act relating to the refund of unused balance of personal leave upon termination.
Yeah, he wants to be here.
Okay. I must have over that. He is here. I'm not here. We've got Senate Bill 139. This is to hear to testify.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Bert Wagon?
Yes, correct, Mr. Chairman.
Bert Wagon, Deputy Commissioner, Commerce and Economic Development. I reviewed Senate Bill 139 with bond counsel to the authority, Mr. Messenger, who's Commissioner of Revenue. Feel it's a good bill. We don't have any real problem with it. A couple technicalities I might point out, Mr. Chairman. Page 1, line 18, after the word facilities, I think it would be appropriate to include the additional language again in the bill is that you read for tourism or the tourist industry, for industrial parks, for parking facilities. Just for sake of continuity, it should probably be repeated there again also. The rest of the bill appears in fine form from what we can tell. Bond counsel concurs. We have no problem with it. I might point out that Alaska Industrial Development Authority is used primarily for tax-exempt financing. The addition here of the word tourist industry, we have no problem with, but when someone wants to finance something tax-exempt through ADA, they might find they have a problem with Treasury. And while that doesn't create a problem for ADA, I would not want to build any false expectations for those supporting the bill or with the bill. I should also point out that Section 103C of the Internal Revenue Code does allow tax-exempt financing for convention facilities, which would, of course, perhaps tie in with the tourist industry, and that would be appropriate. There is also a small issue exemption that can go up to $10 million for a single project, and that would, of course, be very appropriate because you could get a considerable tourist facility for that, so to speak. I might also point out that there is no credit of the state involved in this whatsoever. We have prepared no financial note accordingly. Each applicant to ADA comes forth with his own credit completely, and whether the financing succeeds or fails is very dependent on how good of a corporate credit the applying firm is. Be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Kelly.
Let me see if I understand how this works now. On the industrial park, for example, does a private outfit come in and say, I want to build an industrial park and I want to borrow some money from the Norfolk Industrial Development Authority?
That would be the first step, yes. What we would then do, I don't have the complete act here. You might want to look at the definition of industrial park, but that's just a technicality. What we would then go through with the applicant on how to structure this. ADA in and of itself has no money. We have no credit. So we would look at the applicant and we would say, you want to build an industrial park? Okay. We'll issue the bonds. Who's going to buy the bonds? And we would work with the applicant. They would have to come up with purchasers of the bonds, be it Bank of America or Rainier Bank or a consortium of underwriters who would sell the bonds as in any other large bond issue. ADA has been successful with about four financings so far. We have about three or four in some various stages. But I should point out that it's primarily been successful for only the larger, more creditworthy firms. We've had very little success with your smaller firms. And by smaller, I mean the smallest issue we've done so far, I think, is about $3 million, Senator. Bonding like this for, say, a $1 million issue, while it can be done, and we are going to do one hopefully at the end of this week for Alaska Airlines, this type of financing arrangement with the fees and expenses that one incurs does not lend itself to the small loan type programs.
Senator Kelly?
Are convention facilities inherent within tourism or the tourist industry, or if one wanted convention facilities included, should it be included directly?
I leave it probably just the way it is, because the IRS specifically mentions convention facilities. And probably what you would have, and not being a bond counsel, please take this with a grain of salt, but I have a suspicion that if you built a large hotel, say, and a certain portion of that hotel was a, quote, convention facility, I would guess that you would see an allocation of cost. That's what the feds would end up making to do. What the convention facility exemption has been used for a lot is large convention facilities like in Dallas, what's the big
Astrodome?
Yeah, things like that. But you can do sports stadiums also.
And one last question. On page 3, the amendment that includes the words and also includes when used as a noun an installment sales agreement, financing agreement, or loan agreement not involving real property. Is that a major amendment to the Act?
Mr. Chairman? No, that was suggested by counsel to the authority. He feels it's just a clarification, and he felt it should be done, and as long as this bill was in, he felt it was necessary. I can get you written reasoning on it, but my understanding, it's a minor drafting correction that perhaps should have been in place when the first statute was, when ADA was originally established.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Wright. Thank you. Chair would entertain a motion to move this one on out.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass that Senate Bill 139 with individual recommendation. I have it passed.
And House Bill 184, I guess we are ready to testify at the group.
No,
84.
84.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill I introduced at the request of a constituent. Take care of a problem that wasn't considered when we made a law change last year. And essentially what we did was change the type of leave that state employees can accumulate. Prior to the law change, and this affects only people in the exempt and partially exempt service because other people negotiate their terms of leave under collective bargaining, but people in the exempt and partially exempt service, we provided for a law change that rather than having sick leave and annual leave, there's only one category of leave now, and that's personal leave. And the under the old system of leave, an employee was allowed to accumulate 60 days of annual leave and an unlimited amount of sick leave. And when it came time to retire or leave state service, he was paid off for the annual leave, and the sick leave just lapsed. The problem now is that we have this one category of personal leave, and the individual is allowed to accumulate an unlimited amount, theoretically after serving a 10, 15, 20 years in state service. The individual may have accumulated a large amount of this personal leave, 8, 10, 12 months, perhaps even more. And the result would be that when the person retires, he retires 10 months into the year, and he's got 10 months worth of accumulated leave, and he's paid off in one lump sum as the law now provides. He's suddenly faced with 20 months of income during the 1 year, and he's taxed on the basis of 20 months. This law change would allow the department to pay it out in installments, monthly installments, and that when he left, he could retire and continue the payout on his leave, at a month at a time until he used up all his accumulated leave. Could have been paid for all his accumulated terminal leave.
Could you tell me, I understand in some of the checking around we're doing on this, that some of the departments are already doing this.
Yeah, I guess some of the departments are. That was the indication I had, but not all. This would, those departments that are doing it, technically in violation of the law.
It's just they don't have any authority to do it particularly.
Yeah, that's my understanding. And that some are doing it, some aren't. And this would give all departments or the authority or give the employee the option of taking it in one lump sum or having it paid out.
There's no fiscal note or no cost to this.
Just a change in the method of payment. As long as it's done on a monthly basis, there's no problem. If somebody wanted his repayment something other than a monthly basis, there might be a cost, but discussion with the department, the indication was they'd either pay in a lump sum or on a monthly basis. So that works in their computer system.
Well, I see if somebody is leaving in July or August, they'd like to have it spread over into the next year, probably get some of that income deferred at least into the next tax year. Any
further discussion or questions? I move our House Bill R 84 out with an individual recommendation.
Thank you.
Give our best to Jim Williams.
Yeah, okay. Oh, that's right. You got a copy of this letter.
Just Mr. Nolan, he said no problem if you were going to pass it out.
Did you have anybody have any?
Well, it sounds like a good idea to me. I've been well versed on it before.
No fine. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
We had a motion to pass that out.
Yes.
And we'll adjourn.